and this is Literary Hour. Today I will be reading to you
Maxwell.
Good afternoon. This is the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Friday, April 13th, 2025. Welcome to our afternoon program. Your readers are Christy Walters and
Lisa Maxwell.
Today we will be reading from the Sports Weekend section from today's News and Observer, Franklin Times, Greensboro News and Record, and the Winston-Salem Journal. All articles are read exactly as printed. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's noon broadcast is generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenzer. At 1:30, our featured program will be Music Review with Randy Thompson. We will now begin with NNO Sports.
And the first article that I have for you, why House settlement with NCAA, now final, effectively changes nothing yet. President of the NCAA, Charlie Baker, speaks during a press conference celebrating the 25-year anniversary of the NCAA moving its national office to Indianapolis on Tuesday, August 13, 2024, at the NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis. It has been a week since the House settlement with the NCAA changed everything about college athletics forever, and yet nothing has really changed. As earth-shaking as the agreement is to dole out billions in back pay to former college athletes while opening the door to revenue sharing, a phrase concocted to give plausible denial that this isn't just the semi-pro operation, universities have been planning for this for so long. The actual finalization of the lawsuit and implementation of its provisions actually amounts to business as what is now usual. 6 months ago, North Carolina's term sheet with Bill Belichick offered $13 million of UNC's roughly $20.5 million revenue-sharing pool would go to football at a time when there wasn't even technically It wasn't even technically legal yet. And the ink on Judge Claudia Wilkins' signature was barely dry before the NCAA and the power conferences started leaking drafts of favorable legislation in Congress. The lobbyists have been waiting years for this moment. All of this has been coming for a long time, and only a dispute over players who are losing their scholarships and roster spots delayed the actual settlement until June. The reality had set in long ago. The House settlement isn't perfect. There are major potential Title IX issues and real concerns over what scholarship caps might do to sports that have traditionally had big rosters like track and swimming. The fact that a big part of the back pay for former athletes is coming from NCAA basketball tournament revenue, while the college football playoff doesn't pay a dime, shifts the financial burden unfairly from big football schools to everyone else. It is, however, better than nothing. It ushers in a new world of college sports, one where athletes can be openly paid by their universities on top of whatever NIL deals they can still gather, one that's long overdue. For one thing, all the money that used to change hands under the table will be in plain view now. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. For another, athletes long ago deserved a piece of the bags of money they generated for athletic directors, coaches, administrators, contractors, vendors, lawyers, and everyone else who suckled at the sugar teat of a college athletic industrial complex built on free labor. College athletes always had value, even if the world pretended they did not. Now they can actually collect. It took a long time for that edifice to fall, and now that it has, none of the fear-mongering from petty tyrants trying to safeguard their turf has come true. Former Big Ten Commissioner Jim Delaney once said his conference would have to drop to Division III if the O'Bannon lawsuit went through. For real. You know what came out of the O'Bannon lawsuit? Cost of attendance payments for players and a long-awaited college football video game that was the best-selling game of last year. The Big Ten seems okay. Amateurism was always a scam. The ideal of the amateur was created by the British gentry to avoid having to compete against the lower classes who couldn't afford to row or play rugby as a hobby. Professionals started competing in the Olympics decades ago, and the world kept right on spinning. There was never any reason why you shouldn't be a student and an athlete and get paid to do it. Teaching assistants get paid. Students with work-study jobs get paid. Natalie Portman appeared in Hollywood blockbusters without compromising her eligibility for Harvard student drama. The only reason athletes were different was because there was so much money coming in that the adults wanted to keep all the profits for themselves. The only reason the NCAA bureaucracy, as we know it, exists is because those adults didn't trust each other not to cheat and pay them anyway. That last part hasn't changed. Part of the House settlement is a new entity, separate from the NCAA, to assure NIL deals remain within fair market value. But if Oklahoma City's biggest Chevy dealer decides it's worth $2 million to his business for the Sooners' left tackle to hang out in his break room, who's some quant at Deloitte to tell him it's not? The phrase unreasonable restraint of trade comes to mind. Even NCAA President Charlie Barker admitted as much at the Final Four, noting that the real value of the NIL clearinghouse is getting a handle on what's actually being spent, something the NCAA and its member schools have no ability to track right now. There may be a fig leaf of enforcement, and even that will be bait for lawsuits, but the real value of what Deloitte is doing is data. There is going to be more upheaval as everyone adjusts to this new world, even with a head start, and a lot of the things fans like least about the past few years of college athletics aren't going to change right away. The transfer portal isn't going anywhere, although the ability to pay players directly may lead to more mutually beneficial arrangements that somehow dilute the current annual free agency system. There's a way to fix all that by moving towards some sort of collective bargaining with athletes that sets terms of pseudo-employment everyone agrees upon. The NCAA would rather push through legislation that sets those terms unilaterally post-house now that it senses favorable winds on Capitol Hill. But House, for all its faults, is a step in the right direction and long overdue. If it doesn't feel like much has changed yet, it's because so much already has. And now we'll go back to Christy.
All right, the Duke women stay home. NC State and UNC play on the road in the 2025 ACC-SEC Challenge. Matchups for the women's ACC-SEC Challenge were released Thursday, with the ACC looking to improve on its success in the last two seasons. Duke will play LSU at Cameron Indoor Stadium, while North Carolina and NC State are hitting the road. The Tar Heels will play at Texas, while the Wolfpack heads to Oklahoma. All six teams are coming off deep 2025 NCAA tournament runs. NC State, UNC, and Oklahoma earned spots in the Sweet 16, while Duke and LSU played in the Elite Eight. Texas earned a spot in the Final Four. NC State plays on December 3rd, while Duke and Carolina play on December 4th. This is the third consecutive ACC-SEC Challenge in which the SEC leads in the Women's Challenge, 17-13 across two seasons. The SEC won the 2024 challenge 10-6, and the two conferences tied 7-7 in 2023. NC State leads the triangle with a 2-0 record in the challenge. It beat Vanderbilt 70-62 in 2023 and Ole Miss 68-61 last season. This will be the Wolfpack's first ACC-SEC challenge on the road. NC State and Notre Dame are the only two ACC programs to win their first two games in the annual matchup. Duke and UNC are 1-1 in the ACC-SEC challenge. The Blue Devils will play at home for the first time, while the Tar Heels go on the road for the first time. Duke fell to South Carolina 81-70 in Columbia last season. A year prior, the Devils defeated Georgia 65-58 in Athens. UNC is coming off a 72-53 win over Kentucky at home, defeating former Virginia Tech head coach Kenny Brooks. In the first ACC-SEC challenge, the Tar Heels lost to South Carolina 65-58 at Carmichael Arena. The ACC women have fared much better against the SEC than the men, who have a 9-21 record. Because the ACC has 18 teams and the SEC has 16, two teams will not participate. This year, Wake Forest and Boston College are not playing in the challenge. Times and television designations will be announced at a later date.
And the next article I have for you, UNC tennis player Reese Brantmeyer's comeback leads to U.S. Open qualifier again. 8-year-old Reese Brantmeyer stared out her classroom window at a pair of tennis courts where overgrown weeds sprouted from cracks in the green and red surface. A rusted fence surrounded the neglected space outside of Washington Elementary in Whitewater, Wisconsin. There was no net, only the empty poles, faded white lines, and memories. Frustration consumed the fourth grader when she packed her gear into her mom's car to take tennis lessons in Lake Geneva, 45 minutes away. The two courts at her elementary school mocked her from afar. A teammate on her basketball team had picked up tennis, but hated making the 45-minute commute alone, so she asked Brantmeyer to join her. Brantmeyer enjoyed it enough to keep going, but the future UNC women's tennis star wished she could play in Whitewater. Her school was only 10 minutes away from her house in rural Cold Springs, population 786. But she had no choice. Wisconsin is a tennis desert. It's difficult to play year-round and it's expensive. A large portion of the population of the east side of Whitewater, which includes Washington Elementary, is classified low income. 29% of Whitewater's residents live in poverty, according to U.S. Census data. Even as her tennis skills and ambition have outgrown Wisconsin, Brantmeyer hasn't forgotten the sight of those courts outside her classroom window. She thought about the courts as she qualified for the U.S. Open at 14 and again at 16. They remained on her mind when a dispute with the NCAA over prize money cost her the first semester of her freshman year, and as she led UNC to its first ever national championship in spring of 2023. They were certainly on her mind when a torn meniscus ripped her away from the sport and shattered North Carolina's chances of going back-to-back, and when she sued the NCAA over those prize money rules. And now, as the 20-year-old Brantmeyer works to come back from a second meniscus injury and earned a U.S. Open doubles wild card at a playoff in Orlando on Tuesday, the thought of those courts has not abandoned her. Since she was in the fourth grade, her mother, Becky, said, she said, "I'm going to become famous and I'm going to fix those courts." Now the rusted chain link fence is gone. The weeds and cracks, too, replaced with new, smooth asphalt. It's not completed yet, still a work in progress, but so is Brantmeyer. ahead 3-1 in doubles against Southern California with partner Elizabeth Scotty, looking to put UNC ahead in the round of 16 in the 2024 ITA Indoor National Championship in Seattle. Brantmeyer swayed behind the baseline. North Carolina returned its entire starting lineup from the 2023 NCAA title run and was aiming for a fifth straight indoor title that February with hopes of an NCAA repeat in the spring. On the serve, Brantmeyer split-stepped. Her right knee popped. Something snapped. Her mother could see the pain on Brantmeyer's face. "The second I took that step, I knew," Brantmeyer said, "I was not going to be playing tennis like I'd been for a good amount of time." Excuse me. To avoid putting pressure on the rest of the team, Brantmeyer stayed and played standing still, even though it meant watching Scotty cover the court like a singles match. After the pair won 6-3, trainers carted Brantmeyer off the court. UNC finished off USC, but lost to NC State 4-3 the next day without Brantmeyer. The on-site doctor said she had patellar subluxation. Her kneecap had popped out. It moved back into place on its own, so she could be back competing in 2 weeks. But she wasn't. An MRI back in Chapel Hill revealed a bucket handle tear of her meniscus, a notoriously slow-healing injury. "It was just shock," Brantmeyer said, "and a lot of disappointment." Doctors gave Brantmeyer 2 options. 1, repair her meniscus, hoping to increase her health and longevity as an athlete, sit out for 6 months. 2, remove it completely, sit out for 2 months. She settled on the repair at her doctor's recommendation. Brantmeyer's mother, Becky, traveled to North Carolina to be with her daughter. That repair usually takes 4 or 5 permanent sutures. Brantmeyer required 12, a record for her surgeon. She was bedridden in her mother's hotel room. "It was the most pain I've ever been in," she said. "Then came blood clots, which set back the healing process. I told her I'd stay there until she had 1 day without complications," Becky said. She stayed a week. "It didn't get any easier. Walking to class on crutches exhausted Brantmeyer. She skipped some days because of the pain. Still, she traveled to every match. If she couldn't be on court, she felt she at least owed the team that much. Somebody gets injured, something gets taken away, their attitude goes south," head coach Brian Kalbus said. "Hers never went south. But the losses weighed on her." Confined to the sidelines of the NCAA Super Regional, Brantmeyer watched as the team's hopes for another national championship crashed. First, Texas A&M took the doubles point, clinching on court one, where Brantmeyer should have been playing. Then 3 single matches. Once again, the clinch came at the number one seed, her court. "I would have given anything to be able to help out," Brantmeyer said. Who was Brantmeyer without tennis? This wasn't the first time she'd faced that question. In the fall of her freshman year, before her first individual tournament, the NCAA began investigating some of her prize money and expenses from high school. Prior to college enrollment, athletes can accept up to $10,000 per calendar year in prize money from professional tournaments. Beyond that, they can only accept money to cover actual and necessary expenses, like meals, lodging, equipment, and other reasonable expenses. Brantmeyer's family said they never received an itemization of what was being disputed, only random questions, particularly related to the $49,000 for making it to the third round of the 2021 U.S. Open Singles qualifying tournament and the main draw in doubles. Her mother had bought a receipt scanner to track their expenses. The NCAA questioned if it was necessary, as well as a racket restringing outside of a 14-day competition window and a hotel room 16-year-old Brantmeyer shared with her mother at the U.S. Open. The NCAA refused to certify her amateur status for 4 months, rendering her ineligible for the fall semester. I had come to college to play tennis, and that was all I'd done my whole life, Brantmeyer said. So not being able to do that, I kind of was a little lost. I didn't really know why I'm here. The NCAA did not respond to a request for a comment. At the end of winter break, the NCAA ruled she had to pay $5,100 to a charity of her choice. Then she could finally play college tennis. She remembered the courts. Brantmeyer donated the money to the Patrick Ryan Memorial Tennis Foundation, aimed at promoting tennis in Wisconsin. She grew up taking lessons where David Ryan, the organizer of the foundation, also played. She asked him to resurface the courts in her hometown. After her donation, Brantmeyer found out it needed more work. The estimated total, $200,000. She offered to become the spokesperson. She fundraised, wrote grants, networked with pro players and UNC donors, ran clinics. A year later, she turned to the work during her injury. It made the weeks and months on the sidelines go by a little quicker. I hadn't thought about tennis for myself in a long time, Brantmeyer said. I was trying to give tennis back to a lot of people. In March 2024, she sued the NCAA. The legal action seeks a change in the prize money rules, specifically the ban on athletes' ability to receive money for outside competitions beyond expenses. When the distinction was you cannot make money at all, and that was the line that they drew, that's a fair distinction between amateur and pro, Brantmeyer said. But now in this NIL era that we're in, it's just out of date. 8 months after the surgery, Brantmeyer's knee still hurt. It made strange noises when she moved. A scope procedure in the fall of 2024 revealed the meniscus cartilage never healed. The repair had failed. So back under the knife she went. This time, surgeons removed her meniscus, resetting all progress. Ending up now without my meniscus, knowing that I could have done that earlier and played for the team by the end of the spring, was really tough to know, Brantmeyer said. But obviously, hindsight's 20/20. She woke up from her procedure in October and felt she could walk on her knee immediately. Brantmeyer couldn't join the team in practice until January, right before the first match of the season against James Madison. She came back early to school from winter break to train, but only played one practice set. I truly had no idea if I was going to be ready, Brantmeyer said. But it was to a point, if I'm physically cleared, it's going to be tough regardless. You've just got to rip the Band-Aid off. She won her first match in straight sets. It was the most fun she'd had playing tennis since she was a kid, making those commutes to Lake Geneva. She was back. Brantmeyer upset the number one singles player in the nation at top-ranked Georgia in February to lead the team to a 4-3 victory. She finished the regular season with a 14-1 singles record and ranked number 7 in the nation. In doubles, Brantmeyer and her partner, freshman Alanis Hamilton, ranked number 2 with a 23-3 record. She clinched North Carolina's 2025 ACC Tournament Championship and was named Tournament MVP. 4 days later, the ACC named her Player of the Year. At the height of her game, she led UNC to the NCAA Tournament quarterfinals in May. Then, after hitting a serve in her singles match against LSU, Brantmeyer landed awkwardly. Wincing, hands gripped her right leg. She called an injury timeout, but the pain in her knee was too much. She retired from the match, recording only her second loss of the season. Trainers carried her off the court again. This time, it was a slight tear in her medial meniscus, the remaining pad of cartilage in her knee. 2 days later, UNC's season ended in the NCAA semifinals with a 4-0 loss to Georgia. She has been playing such good tennis, the best tennis I've seen all semester, senior teammate Lindsay Zink said. It's been tough to see her get re-injured, but I know she's going to come back better than ever. Washington Elementary Principal Tom Grosinski stood outside the Whitewater School in May. He took out his phone and hit record. "Hey, Reese, it's Mr. G here," Grosinski said in the video. "I thought you wanted to see something pretty awesome." He flipped the camera to pan across the scene around him. Every time there's changes on those no longer abandoned courts, he records an update and sends it to Brantmeyer. In the first video, the removal of the rusted fencing. Next, the stripping of the cracked surface down to sand. Most recently, the laying of the base level pavement. Everyone has a vision, a hero or someone they've admired. Gregory Stewart, an assistant coach for the girls' tennis team at Whitewater High, said, "Reese is that within our community." Weeks have passed since Brantmeyer's latest injury, but she's returning to training. Tuesday, she and Hamilton will travel to Orlando to face three other collegiate doubles teams. The winner will earn a spot in the U.S. Open. Meanwhile, Brantmeyer versus NCAA is proceeding to discovery. On July 7th, nearly 7 weeks before the U.S. Open, a judge will decide whether to certify it as a class action suit. If granted, a trial is expected to follow in the summer of 2026. And as for those courts in Whitewater, Brantmeyer has raised more than $159,000 in 3 years. Until the crew broke ground this summer, a green sign decorated the fence outside as a reminder that she hadn't forgotten, in white, bold lettering. "Help us renovate these courts and bring tennis back to the East Side, the Reese Brantmeyer Project." That name is appropriate for the Whitewater Tennis Court Reclamation Project, but also for Brantmeyer's ongoing journey through the tennis world. The former appears close to a positive resolution. The latter appears to be just getting started again.
Talk about perseverance. Okay, I have to describe the cover picture for this article to really give you a sense. It's a sports article, but it's a bit fun. So there is a photo of a woman sitting in stadium-style seating, and she's wearing a Durham Bulls T-shirt, and it looks like she's at a Durham Bulls game, but on her lap is a tabby cat, and who is apparently named Hermione. And think through it with me. The title of this article is "Take Meowt to the Ball Game. Durham Bulls Appeal to Cat Owners on a Special Night." Forget Bark in the Park. Cats got their opportunity to have a night out, and no, it wasn't a complete catastrophe. The Durham Bulls hosted their first Whisker Wednesday at Durham Bulls Athletic Park for their game against the Charlotte Knights, allowing fans to bring their felines for an evening of baseball. "My 8-year-old black cat Kiki not only enjoys going outside, but loves being around people. Seriously, she is a terrible guard cat. So I decided to take her to Whisker Wednesday and see what it was all about. We packed up her stroller with a portable fan, cold water, her favorite water bowl, treats, and her harness and leash. She has been leash trained for more than 6 years. As a sports fan and reporter, I always felt like cats were overlooked. There are plenty of stereotypical scaredy cats, but some are well-behaved and enjoy being out and about. They deserve their own opportunities for social interaction, too. Other cat parents felt the same, wanting to take advantage of the chance to spend time with their kitties in public. It's nice. I never thought I'd bring my cat to a Durham Bulls game, that they would have a cat night here, said Carla Light, owner of 6-year-old tabby Hermione. That's so cool. I love that they're doing it. Andy Spence and Avery Asciano brought their 1-year-old cats, Steve and Wanda, brother and sister from the same litter. Twister and Tyrion came with their cat dad, Cam Belondo. The humans said they brought their furry friends because they don't typically get chances to bring their cats to events. Let me say I loved the idea, but I think the execution was flawed. Feline fans were required to be up to date on all vaccines, kept on a leash or in a carrier at all times. Additionally, they were seated in a cat-specific section. I understand the separate seating areas, but with a 6:35 p.m. first pitch, putting the felines in the outfield section with the late afternoon sun shining on them was not the ideal location, at least not without any sort of cooling tent, shade, or fans. Dogs are also seated there for Bark in the Park events, which I think should change. I counted 9 other cats, including the famous Bull City Kitty, Keely Jones, so the contingent was tiny but mighty. We also met Elvie in Scotland, though there were a handful that showed up after we left or that we did not interact with directly. With such a limited number of pet patrons, I think there could have been a dedicated section along the left field line, near the bullpen, that would have provided a cooler temperature and space away from the general fan population. Kiki had a wonderful time experiencing the sights and sounds early in our visit. She appreciated receiving pets from new friends, posing for photos, and walking around. After all, she's known around our neighborhood for being the cat on a leash. But unlike some of the other cats, we only lasted an hour before heading home. Maybe I should have arrived closer to 7:30 when the sun had disappeared behind the stadium, like some of the other pet parents. I learned re-entry is allowed at DBAP if you speak to a gate attendant, so cooling off in the car and returning is allowed. That may be an option for us in the future. The event follows the emergence of several cat-themed promotions from minor league teams across the country. The Rock City Trash Pandas in Alabama, the Richmond Flying Squirrels in Virginia, the Worcester Red Sox in Massachusetts, that's probably pronounced Wooster, and Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp in Florida, all hosted their own cat nights, appropriately named Toe Bean Tuesday or Purr in the Park in the past month. I am so excited. I saw on social media other ballparks doing it. I tagged the Durham Bulls, and I was like, come on, let's go, says Kim Ryder, owner of Kimmy's Critters Pet Sitting and Cat Mom to Scotland. I'm hoping that's part of why we have it. I think it's great. I think it's so fun. It's such a good opportunity, you know? I think it's wonderful. Some social media users expressed criticism, calling the events a bad idea or saying all felines are antisocial and afraid. Every owner and team, including the Bulls, encouraged attendees to consider their cats' needs before bringing them to the event and to only bring those that can handle being around people, other felines, and possible loud noises. Ryder and Light said fans need to know their cats. Just as some dogs are not suited for Bark in the Park, not every cat will thrive at Whisker Wednesday. Additionally, pet parents need to be aware when they might need to leave early for their pet safety. I think cats all have different personalities, just like people, Ryder said. Some cats enjoy this, and that's the ones you bring. Some don't, and you don't bring them. I think it's as simple as that. All cats were required to have a ticket. Proceeds were donated to Second Chance Pet Adoptions, reflecting the Bulls' longstanding partnership with local animal rescue organizations and support of animal welfare. Proceeds from the team's regular Bark in the Park events also go toward animal rescue and rehabilitation efforts. In addition to Second Chance, the team has partnered with Animal Protection Society of Durham and Neuse River Golden Retriever Rescue. Carolina Panthers mascot Sir Purr and North Carolina Courage mascot Rory attended the event as well. Overall, I enjoyed spending time with my girl and meeting other pet parents. I would attend another game with Kiki if there is another Whisker Wednesday, but suggest the Bulls make seating modifications or that fans arrive after first pitch. This could also be a great promotional opportunity for college baseball and softball teams, especially during fall or early in the regular season when the weather is milder. When I asked Kiki her thoughts, she meowed in agreement. It wasn't perfect, but maybe we can try again under different conditions. There's a fun sports article, and that closes out our sports section. So Lisa's going to start us off with NNO is articles from the living section.
And the first article I have for you, iconic all-American restaurant chain plans to open 3 more locations. A&W Restaurants, the 105-year-old all-American-style restaurant chain, announced that it has plans to expand and open up at least 3 more stores in the near future. The exciting news comes a little over 1 week after A&W, which now operates over 850 locations worldwide, debuted its newest storefront and its first in the city of Darlington, South Carolina on June 4th. But it won't be the last grand opening the state sees, as A&W said it wants to open at least three more in the area over the next few years. The news of A&W's expansion is the shimmer of light in the dark tunnel of bad news from several other legendary franchises struggling financially and have either filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy or announced mass closures. A&W Restaurants has become part of communities across the country by serving classic all-American food and offering a welcoming hometown experience. CEO and president of A&W Restaurants, Betsy Chamant, said in a June 12th statement, adding, "We're committed to helping franchise owners build something lasting, something they can be proud to pass down for generations. As for where exactly the chain wants to open up shop, it may be too early to tell, as A&W is still seeking potential franchise partners. That said, the company is eyeing the capital city of Columbia and other areas nearby." Pardon me. "We see tremendous potential in Columbia and its neighboring cities, where passionate, community-driven entrepreneurs can help us continue our legacy of bringing people together," the exec concluded. All righty, now we'll go to Christy for that next article.
This one, I think, is timed aptly since we're going into summer and it's Father's Day weekend. Which Raleigh grocery store has the best prices for summer grilling? We checked. All right. With warmer temperatures and longer days, summer beckons outdoor gatherings. A focal point of many of these celebrations, whether planned or casual, is food. Meats charred on a grill, seasonal produce, salty snacks, and ice-cold sweet treats grace the tables of Father's Day celebrations, 4th of July parties, and weekend cookouts. Food prices have also been top of mind for many Americans for months, and several grocers in the Triangle have already cut prices on common summer purchases. Grocery prices may not be the only factor shoppers consider when deciding where to buy their food. But to help people make those decisions, the News and Observer checked prices of popular cookout ingredients at grocery stores in Raleigh. Here's what we found. Where to buy cookout supplies in Raleigh. They visited 13 stores in Raleigh to check prices of 7 different food items. There is a map that shows where they shopped, and it looks to be downtown Raleigh, slightly east, a little north where the North Hills area is, and then they went pretty far north Raleigh. They compared prices of 7 summer cookout staples, all name brand items, including Coca-Cola, a 2-liter bottle, Ballpark hot dog buns, an 8-count package, Breyers vanilla ice cream, a 1.5-quart carton, Heinz ketchup, 20-ounce bottle, Lay's classic potato chips, 8-ounce bag, Modelo Especial beer, 6-pack, and Nathan's bun length skinless beef franks, an 8-count package. Oh, look at that. They found a hot dog buns and hot dog package that both have 8 quantity. I didn't realize that existed. Best prices for grilling cookouts in Raleigh. Well, there were some consistencies. Prices of items varied across the stores. Harris Teeter, Publix, and Lowe's Foods tended to charge the most for the items on our list. For each item we compared, the difference in price between the most expensive and least expensive store was at least a dollar. The item with the greatest variance in price was Nathan's hot dogs. It cost $9.19 at Publix and $4.49 at Aldi. That's a $5 difference. Lisa's cringing over here. The actual cost a shopper pays at the register may be lower with the store's loyalty program, special promotions, or coupons. 8 stores carried all 7 items on our list. If a shopper purchased all 7 items at the same store, the bill would be between $31.65 and $44.23. The cheapest store overall is Walmart, and the most expensive is Harris Teeter. Both of these stores have kept for years a high market share among Triangle grocers. And it looks like, I'm just taking a look at this article, it looks like the remainder of the article is, they've got a graph in here for the cost that shows the different items and the total cost. And it shows the Walmart at $31.65 to purchase all seven items, and then the Harris Teeter at $44.23. So if we were to look at the average, it looks like Food Lion was right there in the middle. So that'll come in handy this weekend with Father's Day. Okay, back over to Lisa.
Well, it looks like our living section is food-related today, because my next article involves an iconic North Carolina shrimp burger spot, which is back after closing for updates. A piece of summer was missing last year in North Carolina. L's Drive-In, a generations-old shrimp burger destination, was closed. The Morehead City icon skipped the high season in 2024 after tough-timed renovations closed the restaurant for months. Now, with an expanded kitchen and a bit of sprucing, L's returns for one of its biggest weekends of the year. L's opened in January after 9 months of renovations. Third-generation owner Shelton Frank said Morehead City beat the doors down when the restaurants finally removed the construction fence and put L's sign back up. "We'll never have a January that busy," Frank said. "We had a record month." L's closed in April of 2024 after years of delayed renovations finally caught up with the restaurant, but they didn't do any drastic overhauls to the beloved drive-in. The main changes are in the kitchen, where Frank's doubled the cooktop space by moving the grill and expanded the number of fryers from 2 to 5. They also updated some of the wiring. Despite closing at the worst possible time last spring, Frank said it was a relatively easy decision. "We were band-aiding issues from 1959," Frank said. "There were days when it didn't really matter how hard we worked. There was no way to keep up with the 4 lanes of Highway 70. I knew I couldn't survive another busy summer like that." L's is a right-hand turn to the Atlantic Ocean and has been a treasured lunch spot for families and diners still shaking the sand from their hair. Part of that allure is L's signature shrimp burger, a North Carolina coastal delicacy of fried-to-order shrimp, coleslaw, and ketchup on a bun. "It's that simple," Franks said. "I feel like we're the ones that started out, but everyone around town has their own twist on it. It's what we're known for." This summer, Shelton Franks is largely in charge of L's, taking over operations from his father, Mark, who took over from his father 30 years earlier. Shelton was hesitant to say his father was fully retired. "He'll never be fully retired," Shelton said. "He wakes up every morning and preps the bacon for the day." The youngest Frank said he only briefly entertained the idea of college and life outside of L's before committing to the restaurant. Last year, he and cousin Ty Mason opened L's East in Smyrna, opening the brand to a new location and handling some of the demand of a summer without the original. L's East will remain open and operated by Mason. "We never really missed a beat," Frank said. "We closed here in Morehead City on a Sunday and opened L's East on Monday. The high season for L's starts on Memorial Day, but this weekend's big Rock Blue Marlin Fishing Tournament, wrapping up June 15th, is one of the largest sport fishing weekends on the East Coast and also a gigantic draw," Frank said. As Frank's enters his first summer in charge, he sees the renovations and time away as helping preserve the legacy he's inherited. "I think it's pretty much a part of so many people's lives," Franks said. "Most people have drove by it or stopped by or at least heard about it. My goal is I'm just trying to do right by my grandparents." The hours of Elle's Drive-In are open 10:30 a.m. until 9 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and 10:30 a.m. until 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday. And they are located at 3706 Arundel Street in Morehead City.
All right, sticking with the News Observer Living section, People's Pharmacy, what happens when local pharmacies disappear? There was a time when the local pharmacy was a pillar of community life. Joe's grandfather was just such a pharmacist in the early 20th century. The pharmacist knew almost everyone in the neighborhood and was able to give personal health advice and make specialized medications. For more than a century, the, quote, mom-and-pop pharmacy was often the hub of social life. There was frequently a soda fountain where customers could get milkshakes or ice cream and share local gossip. Those days are long gone. Many independent pharmacies have been bought out by chain drugstores. The soda fountain has disappeared, and in its stead are aisles of candy, bottled beverages, beauty products, and disposable diapers, to name just a few of the items on sale. Now, though, pharmacies are closing at an alarming rate. A study published in the journal Health Affairs in December of 2024 found that nearly one-third of pharmacies that were operating between 2010 and 2021 had closed. Independent pharmacists, especially those serving as the only access for health care in a neighborhood, were most vulnerable. The Ohio Board of Pharmacy recently reported that 215 drugstores had closed in 2024. That means the number of pharmacies in the state had dropped to the lowest number in memory. It wasn't just independents that shuttered their doors. Over 180 large chain pharmacies closed, along with 19 independent stores and 14 small chain pharmacies. The trend continues. Already in 2025, 35 pharmacies have closed in Ohio. Such closings are creating pharmacy deserts across the United States. Even large chain drugstores like Walgreens, CVS, and Rite Aid are closing many locations. Walgreens was planning on closing up to a fourth of its storefronts before it sold itself to a private equity firm. Such organizations are renowned for scooping up distressed businesses and wringing out profits. Why are so many pharmacies in trouble? Part of the problem, experts say, are the middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. These organizations sit between the insurance companies and the drugstores, controlling reimbursement rates for roughly four-fifths of the prescriptions filled in this country. If they reduce what they pay the pharmacies, they can put more money in their own pocketbooks. Many analysts believe that this squeeze has made it much harder for pharmacies to survive. Another explanation is that mail-order pharmacy services have seen rapid growth over the last decade or so. Just as people now buy their pet supplies and electronic devices online, so too they are increasingly turning to mail-order or direct delivery for prescriptions. Why should we care about the decline in local pharmacies? For one thing, it makes it much harder to pick up an urgent prescription or over-the-counter medication. We also worry about mail-order deliveries. When vulnerable medications are allowed to sit in hot mailboxes or on doorsteps for hours, they may deteriorate. The FDA has strict guidelines for storage and shipping, but delivery vehicles rarely meet these criteria. Even more worrisome is the loss of personal contact. Neighborhood pharmacists had personal relationships with their customers. They were able to discuss health concerns and provide counseling, as well as monitor for side effects and drug interactions. Without a local pharmacy, many people will have a harder time getting access to critical health care information.
All right, and now we are going to start with our articles from the Franklin Times, and the first one I have for you is titled, Woman Shot in Home Was Not the Target. Prosecutors revealed that a 69-year-old woman killed in a drive-by shooting was not the intended target. Her grandson was. Assistant District Attorney Jamie LaMancusa said four suspects were responsible for gunning down Bernice Pender Massenburg inside her Burt Wilson Road on April 1st, killing her when they fired shots in retaliation for a shooting incident that took place in Warren County days before. Lamancusa made the pronouncement during a June 6 bond hearing in Franklin County Superior Court, arguing against setting a bond for Anarie Ananias Brown. Brown, 19, Nizir Carrion Miller Stevenson, 18, Jaquan Lynch, 23, and Donovan Boyd, 22, all of Warrington, are being held without bond for their role in the shooting. Lynch and Boyd were arrested on April 11th, and Miller Stevenson was arrested on April 22nd. A warrant for arrest was issued for Brown on April 28th. Brown surrendered himself to authorities, his attorney, Mitch Stiers, told Superior Court Judge Shamika Reinhart, as he argued for a $250,000 bond, which would include, among other things, house arrest with his mom, an ankle monitor, and social media bans. He is an ideal candidate for house arrest, Steyer said, noting that Brown has no record, lives in Warrington, and has no reason to come to Franklin County, would have no contact with co-defendants, and would relieve the prison system of housing Brown. That's when Lamancusa revealed Brown's role in the murder. There were two groups of young men in this case that had a disagreement, Lamancusa said. There is some evidence that perhaps one of the individuals from one group stole a firearm from an individual in the other group, which caused some issues. Then Brown and some of his co-defendants were at a cookout in Warren County that took place shortly before the murder. Some individuals from the other group allegedly shot at Brown and his co-defendants while they were at the cookout. It's alleged that a couple of those individuals maybe were grazed by bullets at that time, Lamancusa said. So Brown and his co-defendants had motive for trying to get back at the individuals that were alleged to have been part of that shooting. As a result, Brown and his co-defendants went to the house of one of the individuals they believed to be involved in the shooting, where he lives with his grandmother. Lamancusa said that evidence suggests that one of the suspects went to the Burt Winston Road home the day before the shooting, apparently to case out the place. And she said evidence put Brown at the scene of the crime and a gun in his hand. Lamancusa said the state believes that several of the suspects had guns and fired shots. Evidence puts a gun in Brown's hand and put him at the scene of the murder, so we're asking that the court not set a bond, Lamancusa said. To Steyer's point about Brown's surrender, Lamancusa said Brown did that because law enforcement was closing in and co-defendants had fingered him. Until that point, Brown was living with no apparent remorse. This shooting took place on April 1st, Lamancusa said. Brown was able to be at that murder scene and then continue enjoying his life as if nothing happened. He went to the prom, Lamancusa said. He has had a good time since this happened. Lamancusa then gave way for Massenburg's family to petition the courts to keep Brown in jail. They took our sister away from us for nothing, said Massenburg's sister, Joyce Pender Morgan. It was senseless. She was a person that didn't bother anyone, Morgan said. She was a person that loved people and loved children. Anything that they needed from her, all they had to do was ask. Why would someone just take her life? There were members of Brown's family in the courtroom also, but they were not called to speak on his behalf. I know Brown's family loves him, Morgan said. They're supposed to love him, and I've got to love him in spite of, because if I don't love him, I don't go to heaven, and I don't plan to go to hell by no man. In his final argument, Steyers noted that caseloads and limited resources in the district could mean that Brown's case doesn't get heard for years, arguing that having Brown spend that time on house arrest would be a better option than having him be a burden on the jail system. If Mr. Brown is restricted at his home, he's not going around the community, Stiers said. He doesn't have a problem if a judge wants to ban his social media, so there is no way he can communicate with anyone who would potentially influence or offend Ms. Massenburg's family. All of those restrictions could be put in place, and instead of sitting in the Warren County Jail, he would be at home with the same restrictions, Stiers said. That's what we're asking, and I don't think there's any idea that Mr. Brown has any intention of running or any intention that he is going to commit another crime. He never had before. It wasn't enough to sway Judge Reinhart, though, as she denied modifying Brown's bond. Brown has yet to be indicted, so it was not clear when next he would appear in court. As soon as he's indicted, we'll get him put on the Superior Court master calendar, Lamancusa said. I intend to indict it as soon as I can, wade through all of the discovery. It's voluminous, but I'm going to try to indict him as soon as I can. Miller Stevens is next slated for court on August 4th. Lynch and Boyd are next slated for court on August 19th.
Staying in the Franklin County Times, we've got an article out of Lewisburg. School's permission policy takes the wind out of GOP's request. An unusual confluence of events Monday night took most of the, quote, wind out of a request from the Franklin County Republican Party involving age-appropriate books in local school libraries, leaving the request not formally presented and no vote was taken. The GOP passed a resolution at its convention on March 15, 2025, and asked that the school board consider it as the Blueprint 2030 plan was developed. When the school system posted the Blueprint 2030, the draft strategic plan, on its website for public comment, someone anonymously posted the resolution in its entirety, and that in turn prompted Superintendent Rhonda Schuler to share the resolution along with other public comments submitted on Blueprint 2030 as part of her presentation seeking board approval of the strategic plan. Within the presentation, she provided a district response to each feedback submission. Both the resolution and her response were read at the school board's request during Monday's meeting. Here is the gist of the GOP resolution. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Franklin County School Board of Education adopt a policy that content provided by and or in conjunction with Franklin County schools must be age and content appropriate as per a transparent, parent-accessible rating system such as the MPA rating system and inappropriate content that does not promote excellent academic skills, good citizenship, or future success in legal employment should not be available to students via Franklin County Schools, its administrators, its teachers, its staff, its contractors, or others affiliated with Franklin County Schools. Dr. Schuler responded that, as a reminder, Franklin County Schools has a policy in place that addresses parental review and objection to instructional materials, including library books. Policy 3210, Parent Inspection of and Objection to Instructional Materials, along with its accompanying regulation and forms, outlines the steps for requesting a review or consideration of a book. The process begins at the school level, where a parent must complete and submit the appropriate form to the principal. A committee will then review the request and provide a report with its decision and rationale. If the parent is not satisfied with the outcome, they may request a district-level review. Following that process, the parent has the right to appeal the decision to the Board of Education. To date, we have not had a formal book challenge brought forward by a parent during my 7 years as superintendent, and to my knowledge, not in my 11 years with Franklin County Schools. However, as of April 14th, we implemented a new system that provides parental notification when a student wishes to check out a book flagged by the rating system utilized by several organizations, including the Pavement Project. Parents must give permission before the book can be issued. The approach reflects our belief and is supported by our policies that decisions about what children can read are best made by parents. Then, when the school board reached the point in the agenda when Ed Strickland, chair of the Franklin County Republican Party, was expected to present the resolution that already had been read, he declined to do so. Instead, he simply told the board that he was, quote, encouraged that the policy had been changed on April 14th. Adding another level of interest Monday was that before this library issue was even broached in public, four persons spoke out against book banning in school libraries. Those speakers were Sean Mamato, Andrea Wooden, Ben Chapman of Clayton, and Tom Flaherty of Wake Forest. Mamato told the board that teachers are not groomers, are not pedophiles, and called for teachers to be defended. In addition, he said, such regulations as proposed are, quote, being imposed on us by people who do not read books. Wooden, newly elected chair of the Franklin County Democratic Party, said that, quote, parents of Franklin County children have the right to restrict the books their children read, but they can't tell other children what to do. Chapman, a librarian himself, questioned why the GOP resolution was, quote, adopted in private. Shouldn't it have been made public, he asked. He said that his library colleagues deserve respect and confidence, adding that a county named after the founder of the American library system should not be considering book bans. Flaherty told the board that, quote, books don't corrupt minds, and noted that Franklin County already has clear policies. We should stand for education over ideology, he said, adding that the proposed resolution was not about serving the best interests of students. One speaker, Rose Holmes, spoke in favor of the GOP's resolution. She said the target was age-inappropriate books that may be available to students. She said the Pavement Project had identified some books that may be harmful to minors and called for the district to have a clear policy about such books. Ultimately, the GOP policy was never formally presented to the school board, and no vote was taken about it.
And our next article from the Franklin Times, Judicial Complex Faces Another Delay. The Lewisburg Town Council approved one action to make the town safer, but will place a financial burden on businesses. And a motion that died for lack of a second creates a delay for the county's judicial complex. Fire Chief Russell Fuller and Planning Director Terry Satterwhite presented an ordinance change requiring all businesses in town to be outfitted with Knox boxes, a unique locked box where property owners would leave keys to their businesses on site so firefighters can gain emergent entry on fire calls. If there's ever a fire, the fire department usually has to break down doors to enter a building, Satterwhite said. This would eliminate that. New businesses would have to agree to the device at the time they get building permits. After Tuesday night's action, existing businesses have an undetermined amount of time to comply. Staff said they notified new businesses that this was on the table, but admitted they had not reached out to existing businesses. That's why we need a time frame, at least probably 6 months, to get the word out and let them know, said Satterwhite, who said the devices generally run about $400. Whatever the grace period becomes at that time, code enforcement would be responsible for enforcing the ordinance. It was not clear Tuesday night what the penalty would be for noncompliance. The ordinance amendment was approved by unanimous decision. What was less decisive was the town's feelings about W. Johnson Street and its impact on the county's judicial complex. Lewisburg agreed to close a portion of the street to accommodate the parking, expansion, and renovation of Franklin County's Hamilton Hobgood Courthouse Annex, essentially creating a new judicial complex. The annex property is zoned planned development to accommodate the county's renovation and construction plans. When the road was determined to be closed, the goal was to extend that zoning to include the road and the property the county has agreed to buy from the town, adjacent to Riverbend Park, which would be used for parking. Satterwhite said, when a road is closed, the street is divided equally to each adjoining property owners, in this case, the town of Lewisburg and Tamani Anderson Powell, who owns the building at the corner of West Johnson and Main Streets. The county said its plans for the judicial complex don't include using the Anderson Powell property, but council member Dr. Philip Stover was concerned that the building, as it is not subdivided from the gained street property, was included in this zoning change. One of the major concerns about this project is that it ain't going to stop with the complex, Stover said, and we want to protect the rest of the buildings downtown from the county getting a hold of them and tearing them down. I'm going to be real frank about this, Stover said. We're already talking about maybe expanding the historic district down there to further protect these buildings. We do not want to lose any more buildings to the judicial complex, period. End of discussion. Satterwhite said extending the historic district is an option, but the only sure way to have control over the property is to buy it. If the county makes an offer and the property owner accepts it, the county can take it, Satterwhite explained. Council member Baker made a motion to make the zoning amendment, but the action died for lack of a second. It was at that time that Franklin County Assistant County Manager Scott Hammerbacher, who previously served as the county's planning director, questioned if the town's action was legal and whether a public hearing was required. Satterwhite said it's a gray area, and town attorney Ben Williamson said he didn't think a hearing was necessary. However, board members said they believed they would benefit from a public hearing on the matter and suggested hosting one at their July meeting. It's not a bad idea to have a public hearing and get the landowner here and discuss the possibility of carving out the building from the rest of the property, so it's not included in this amendment, Stover said. The council agreed, essentially by consensus, to host a public hearing on the issue next month. And for clarity, Hammerbacher said the county had no plans at this point in time to acquire the Anderson Powell property. And now we'll go back to Christy for our next article.
We've been hearing about that judicial court development for weeks through these articles. It's been going on for a while, yeah. Okay, Franklinton High School has a new principal, and he's a somewhat familiar face around the county school system. Dr. David C. Westbrook was named the FHS principal Monday night, replacing Russell Holloman at the helm of the district's largest high school. The new principal has more than 25 years of experience in education. Dr. Westbrook most recently served as principal of Royal Elementary School, where he guided the school to exceed academic growth expectations for three consecutive years and led efforts that improved the overall performance grade by 10 points. Under his leadership, student attendance improved, discipline referrals declined dramatically, and teacher transitions were strategically managed to maximize instructional quality, according to school officials. These accomplishments earned him the honor of being named Franklin County School's 2024-2025 Principal of the Year. In addition to his leadership at Royal Elementary, Dr. Westbrook has served in a range of administrative roles, including principal at Carver Elementary School, interim principal and assistant principal at Henderson Middle School, and assistant principal and English teacher at Northern Vance High School. He is known for fostering positive school climates, driving academic improvement, and investing in staff development. I am excited for the chance to build on the long, excellent tradition at Franklinton High School, said Dr. Westbrook. Franklinton is a thriving and robust community that offers many opportunities for learners to grow into essential citizens, and it will be my privilege to serve them. Superintendent Rhonda Schuler shared her enthusiasm for Dr. Westbrook's leadership. Dr. Westbrook is a dedicated and visionary leader whose experience and values align perfectly with the mission of Franklinton High School. We are thrilled to welcome him into this new role and look forward to the continued growth and success of our students and staff under his leadership. Dr. Westbrook holds a Bachelor of Science in English Education from North Carolina Central University, a Master of School Administration from North Carolina State University, and a Doctor of Education in Educational Leadership from East Carolina University. Congratulations. Sounds like he's a pretty good principal. Okay, next, Lisa's going to start us off with the Greensboro News and Record.
And the first article I have for you, Stein, biggest jobs announcement in North Carolina history. Kevin Baker broke out in dance as he stood on stage outside the Piedmont Triad International Airport on Thursday afternoon. I'm sorry, for the last few weeks I've been spontaneously breaking out into dance, Baker, PTI's executive director, explained to the crowd. Baker's sense of enthusiasm was shared by the audience, filled with state and local officials who gathered to celebrate JetZero's announcement that they will be building the factory for its new aircraft at the airport in Greensboro. The California-based company is planning to create more than 14,500 jobs and invest $4.7 billion at its production center. The factory will produce the Z-4, an all-wing aircraft with a fuel-efficient design, will allow it to cut carbon emissions by half. In the hours before the meeting, the Guilford County Board of Commissioners approved a $76 million incentive deal with the company. Greensboro City Council approved incentives of $14.56 million, $1,000 per job. Those incentives are performance-based and would be paid out over the course of a decade. At the formal announcement outside the airport, Governor Josh Stein called the project the largest job commitment in North Carolina history. He said the company is expected to bring a total benefit of $250 billion to the state economy. In a press conference following the announcement, Stein said he felt confident JetZero, a startup which began operations in 2021, would be able to make good on their plans to create the new high-tech aircraft. The governor pointed to the company's partnership with airlines such as United and Delta, as well as the U.S. Air Force and NASA. These are strong companies in the aerospace field, and they believe that this is the future of flight in this country, Stein said. He credited the close collaboration between state and local officials of both parties as being critical to the announcement. Stein also said the quality of the state's talent pool was also a big factor. The number one thing we have to offer is our people. We have the best workforce in America, Stein said. Stein presented JetZero CEO Tom O'Leary with a vase from a potter in Seagrove bearing the state motto, "To be rather than to seem." In turn, O'Leary presented a model of the Z-4. O'Leary praised officials at all levels of government in North Carolina for their partnership and said the state is exactly the right place for JetZero. North Carolina is the birthplace of flight, he said. North Carolina is first in flight, and today, with this announcement, the state becomes the epicenter of the next era of flight. During a press conference after the announcement, O'Leary said the company would be ramping up production in the coming years with a goal of producing up to 20 jets per month at its final phase. He said the decision to locate the company's manufacturing at the airport would likely inspire additional growth for the industry in Guilford County. Greensboro has a hub for aerospace and innovations, O'Leary said. I think it will also be a magnet. Whenever you do something of this nature, you're going to draw other people to the state. And now Christy will have.
Okay, pet food maker opens a $115 million plant in Reidsville. Farmina is looking to hire dozens of workers. Farmina Pet Foods has opened its first U.S. manufacturing plant in Reidsville nearly 4.5 years after committing to the $115 million project in December 2020. The 150,000 square foot plant is at 248 Sands Road. The manufacturer said it has hired 75 of its projected workforce of 200 employees. Among available jobs are machine operators, veterinarians, chemical technicians, shipping clerks, maintenance technicians, managers, and supervisors. Both the projected workforce and capital investment are significantly larger than Pharmina initially disclosed. The company originally said it would bring 129 jobs and spend $28.48 million on the facility. The family-owned Pharmina opened in 1975, previously served North American customers with products made in Europe. The Reidsville plant will allow the manufacturer to localize production in order to serve its growing North American market faster and more sustainably. Stokes school officials admit they chose wrong valedictorian after, sometimes these articles, the way they print, can get a little bit confusing. As Italians, family is at heart of everything we do, and that includes our pets, said Loris Rinaldi, chief executive of Pharmina Pet Foods North America. This belief drives us to create the highest quality nutrition for our four-legged family members. With our new Reidsville facility, we're proud to bring European standards, premium ingredients, and personalized support to pet parents across the U.S. Pharmina also has production facilities in Brazil and Serbia and a sales and marketing office in New York City. The campus in Reidsville Industrial Park has research and development operations, including a microbiological and chemical laboratory along with warehousing. The jobs will pay an average $46,722 per year. By comparison, Rockingham County's annual average is $35,146. The company has been made eligible for up to $1.83 million in performance-based incentives over 12 years from the state's Job Development Investment Grant Program. It also will receive local incentives from Reidsville and the County Board of Commissioners. Senate Leader Phil Berger, a Republican from Rockingham, said the Pharmina plant represents a strong endorsement of our skilled workforce and our growing reputation as a business-friendly hub for modern, innovative manufacturing. And now we will hop over to the Greensboro News and Record. Oh, apologies. Let's hop over to the Winston-Salem Journal and make sure we get an article or two out of there.
All right. And from the Winston-Salem Journal, the first article I want to share with you, police elect once-fired union leader to civil service board. The Winston-Salem Police Department chose a longtime police union leader in their first election for the city's civil service board. Brett Moyer is also a man who was once fired as a police officer in a hotly disputed case in city politics. The choice could be viewed as a culmination of the state police union's efforts to intervene in what they call unlawful disciplinary policies. My apologies. Unlawful disciplinary policies and practices put into place by the city of Winston-Salem toward police, according to information from the union's official website. Fired, then reinstated. Moyer, 55, was a Winston-Salem police officer and served as president of the Winston-Salem chapter of the Police Benevolent Association. 2 months ago, he was tapped to join the city's civil service board. In 2003, Moyer was fired by then-Police Chief Linda Davis and accused of violating departmental policies. He had been a Winston-Salem police officer since 1995. Moyer was accused of making a suspect in a traffic stop take off his clothes during a search, rather than doing a search at the police department. Then he was accused of lying during an internal investigation of his conduct, according to previous reports from the Journal. Moyer said earlier this year that he completely denies the allegations and that just before his termination, he had spoken out during a Winston-Salem City Council meeting against a decision to eliminate longevity bonuses for city employees. He said he appealed to be reinstated to his job at the time of his dismissal. Then city manager Bill Stewart eventually overturned the decision by Davis, according to reports from the Journal. After Moyer was reinstated by the police department, he chose not to return. Moyer has since worked as a financial advisor and has served in various capacities in advocacy leadership positions for police officers, according to the Police Benevolent Association website. In the years leading up to his firing, Moyer said he spent time pressing city leaders and Davis for better pay, benefits, and an early version of the grievance board similar to the now current civil service board. Now, Moyer has been elected to the 5-member board. 2 of the 5 positions are elected by the employees of the fire and police departments, respectively. 1 member is appointed by the fire and police chiefs. Another is selected by the city council. A 5th member is selected by the other 4. The city council's appointment was the Reverend Herbert Miller of Emmanuel Baptist Church. "I should have had access to a board like this at that time," said Moyer. "It could have been a very different outcome." Moyer said the civil service board can help Winston-Salem recruit and retain candidates in a time where police departments nationally are struggling to hire. "Part of it is working in a department where you feel like you have a choice," Moyer said. "Having a board like this will ensure better accountability, fairer processes within the police and fire department." City leaders opposed creation of the board. Winston-Salem city leaders have opposed the idea of a civil service panel. Winston-Salem Mayor Alan Joines told the Journal in 2023 that the board strikes at the very heart of the council manager form of government by taking away the power to make decisions. The city council made a unanimous vote in the same year on a resolution to oppose the panel, and the local chamber of commerce also disagreed with its creation. It is unknown whether Moyer may have been targeted by an amendment made to the Civil Service Board bill that Winston-Salem city officials asked for in 2025. Good standing would in turn mean having left without a sustained conduct violation or disciplinary action, particularly any violation or action that would make the former employee ineligible for rehire by the city as determined by the city, according to Senate Bill 189. When asked if Moyer would be fit to serve on the Civil Service Board in light of his past termination, Winston-Salem City Manager Pat Pate said that he believes Moyer meets the state and local requirements to serve on the panel. And now we'll go back to Christy.
All right. Also in Winston-Salem, food distributor moves into former Reynolds plant. Purple Crow opened the door Wednesday on a new era for the Hispanic grocery distributor, as well as breathed new life into the most prominent building on the historic Whitaker Park manufacturing campus. The Winston-Salem company, led by the brother trio of Dan, Nathaniel, and Phil Calhoun, has spent about $61 million to date on buying and renovating the former 850,000 square foot R.J. Reynolds tobacco plant. Purple Crow primarily serves Hispanic food vendors, typically small businesses in North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Maryland, and Virginia. The manufacturers pledged to add up to 274 jobs at an average annual wage of $72,000, as well as retain 186 employees. "This isn't just a ribbon cutting, it's a turning point," said Dan Calhoun, the company's president. "We're proud to celebrate with our community of vendors, customers, and employees who have made this incredible moment possible." Private schools in Forsyth County received more than $18 million in state vouchers in 2024 and 2025. Purple Okay. Apologies. Some of these, I have a hard time sometimes with the articles where they print. Phil Calhoun, a company executive vice president, said being able to buy the building was a blessing in that it was in the right in the middle of town, already in place, and with the space to give us the production space we need since we had maxed out our previous space. To be able to preserve this history in this building and give it a new future, it just worked out beautifully. Purple Crow is the latest anchor tenant of the Whitaker Park Manufacturing Campus Revival, joining Second Harvest Food Bank, Toyota Tsusho, Wake Forest University Nanotechnology Center, speculative industrial buildings, and high-end residential lofts on the campus. Historic site. Reynolds debuted in 1961, the world's largest and most modern cigarette manufacturing plant. It had a workforce of more than 2,000 middle and upper income employees at its production peak. In today's dollars, the $32 million plant would have cost $345 million to build, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Yet, by 2010, Whitaker Park appeared to have outlived its usefulness, succeeded by Reynolds' mammoth 2 million square foot plant in Tobaccoville. Production began ramping down in 2011 and ceased in 2012. The ribbon-cutting ceremony also rewards the tenacity of the Whitaker Park Development Authority's Board of Directors. The nonprofit Whitaker Park Development Authority was created in 2011 by Winston-Salem Business, the Winston-Salem Alliance, and Wake Forest University for the sole purpose of shocking a heartbeat back into the campus. A key crossroads came in April 2017 when Reynolds donated to Whitaker Park Development Authority a total of 120 acres and 13 buildings, including the Purple Crow space. We understand the heritage of this building, which is why we are trying to maintain its look while adding a Purple Crow touch, Phil Calhoun said. Phil Calhoun said the brothers' project the new facility will enable the company to triple its business over the next 5 to 10 years by expanding business with existing customers as well as spreading its wings geographically. Being in this building settles some of our fears we had about not being able to have the space we needed to grow our business at the levels we've envisioned, Phil Calhoun said. We now have the ability to grow substantially organically, to be able to target bigger customers, bigger stores, better compete with U.S. Foods and other competitors. Ken Langone, co-founder of the Home Depot and Purple Crow board member, said he made a pivotal investment in Purple Crow in 2019 and 2020 based on the brothers' vision for growth and their personal and business values. Langone said his initial interest in Purple Crow came from negotiations over leasing trucks from his company. The Calhouns told Langone they were considering selling the company, but for a value not worthy of what they had built. I have a simple approach to investing, Langone said. It's all about the people. The right people doing the right things will always win. All the ingredients were there for them to be successful. They have more than exceeded our most optimistic expectations. The new life provided by Purple Crow is not lost on Winston-Salem Councilwoman Dee Dee Adams, who worked as a tour guide among her many job positions at the Reynolds plant. Several members of her family also worked for Reynolds. To see this building come full circle, going from tobacco to food, going to a product that everyone needs, adding to the diversity of Whitaker Park and the North Ward, it's very encouraging, Adams said. Well, that's exciting news, and that's about all the time we have. I'm Christy Walters.
I'm Lisa Maxwell. I'm Lisa Maxwell.
We have been reading selections from the Sports Weekend section from today's News and Observer, Franklin Times, Greensboro News and Record, and Winston-Salem Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and readily available as a podcast after this broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Today's noon broadcast is generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenzer. It's now time for today's music review with Randy Thompson. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. We hope you have a great day, and happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there.